Welcome, everyone, to the Arthroscopy Association's Arthroscopy Journal podcast. I'm Dr. Andrea Spiker from the University of Wisconsin. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Brian Giordano, who is an associate professor and founder co-director of the Hip Preservation Program at the University of Rochester. Dr. Giordano was the senior author of the article titled "Patient-Reported Outcomes Are Similar in the First 2 Years After Staged versus Combined Hip Arthroscopy and Periacetabular Osteotomy for Hip Dysplasia," which was published in the August 2023 edition of the Arthroscopy Journal. Dr. Giordano's co-authors were Caitlin Orner, Brittany Hawes, John Reuter, Raymond Kenny, and Christopher Cook. Welcome, Dr. Giordano, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Andrea. I really appreciate the opportunity to be part of this. This is really exciting. I'm excited to have a really good discussion about this paper and whatever direction this conversation may go.
Well, thanks again, Brian. And can you start just telling us more about who you are and your practice?
Yeah, sure. So I'm 13 years into practice now. Originally from the Rochester, New York area, so upstate New York, born and bred, and not to be confused with the other Rochester. I did my sports medicine fellowship training program at Curlin Job, and had intended to go back to the University of Rochester, really with the understanding that I was going to initiate a hip preservation program in an area where which was really devoid of any high level hip care at that time. And I remember as a resident, most of our patients would be transferred to to some of the adjacent large cities. So it was a goal of mine to really spend some time after fellowship developing that skill set and that niche interest, and then joining the University of Rochester. Obviously we have the pillars of research and education and clinical excellence and rehabilitative work. And so really trying to marry together all those concepts into a broad comprehensive hip program. And so I was in practice for about a year or two before my partner, Chris Cook, joined us. And Chris was trained in Boston with Dr. Millis. He was actually Ira Zaltz's chief resident, I believe, at that time. And Chris had broad experience in PAOs and we have great chemistry together, so we work really well as co-directors of the program with a really broad gamut of pediatric to adult reconstructive procedures, arthroscopic, open, and hybrid. And more recently, Raymond Kenny, who was one of our former sports fellows, spent a lot of time in Bern, as well as Lyon, France, learning periarticular osteotomies, and so he's joined us as well. So I have the good fortune and to have two partners that both perform high level PAOs that I can work with and think through complex cases with. So that's basically it in a nutshell.
Fantastic. So this paper is perhaps then a good example of what has come from that partnership and focus on hip preservation. So this paper that we're discussing today focuses really on a very important group of patients that we're dealing with in sports medicine, and specifically patients with a dysplastic hip. And so while in sports and those of us who do just hip arthroscopy don't want to treat these patients with hip arthroscopy alone, it's really incredibly important for sports surgeons to be able to identify those patients who need a periacetabular osteotomy. So can you take us first through the generation of this study question and then why you decided to ask the question of whether stage versus combined hip arthroscopy and PAO was the way to go?
Yeah, and I think that question really underscores the evolution of our own practice, not only the history of early hip arthroscopy and where that came from and evolved to, but also the implementation of some of the hybridized strategies as our conceptual understanding improved. Really when I started, we did not have somebody that was capable of performing PAOs. And so we relied on Salters and some of the older versions of osteotomies that really did not have the power to correct more significant structural abnormalities. And so we would use arthroscopy as a tool to try to gain some clinical improvement and functional gain, but clearly we were missing the big picture in a lot of cases. So the evolution of arthroscopy in general, may have started with a few people that really were pioneers in the field, but maybe in some cases, primarily arthroplasty surgeons who could scope hips, and really without any awareness for the more subtle or moderate degrees of dysplasia, without respect for capsular and labral preservation or reconstruction. And so I think the early clinical complications papers, if you go back and you look at those images, we'd say to ourselves now, you know, who would ever scope that, or who would ever use arthroscopy as the index tool to address that condition? And then I think as time went on, we started to gain a greater and broader understanding of, you know, the complexity and the three-dimensional spatial aspects of dysplasia, the soft tissue component, physiologic laxity conditions, and then the functional utilization. And it really, I think, became, you know, a much bigger multi-layered problem. You know, and then with that, the understanding that the treatment of not only labral disease or capsular insufficiency or bony issues, but needed to be paired with, you know, the big picture, in many cases, structural reorientation. And so when we first started, we were starting to see in the literature some of these early complications papers. And, you know, I came into practice a little bit fearful of instability or creating iatrogenic instability in an effort to address labral issues and bony impingement problems. And so with Chris Cook, when he joined the practice, we decided, you know, listen, we're going to be extremely safe. And we believe that there is pretty much always some sort of intra-articular pathology that needs to be addressed. Or at the very least, we need to carefully screen the patients that we're going to be performing the PAO on. So we should do this together, you know, in all cases. And since we have great relationship and mutual respect for each other, you know, we took it upon ourselves to scope every hip that we would do a PAO on. And in doing so, I think we learned quite a bit from each other. You know, we got into some situations early where we're not fearful of a PAO in a 40 or 50 year old with a well-preserved joint space and a healthy physiology. You know, we kind of tapered back on that based on intraoperative findings that may show more significant arthritic pattern than imaging had suggested. And then gradually we started to see some changes that I think we all struggle with in the world, which are inpatient surgical facilities not having the you know, the diversity of skill set and scrub techs or tools or resources to perform efficient high level arthroscopy. And sometimes those things become very frustrating. You know, it's also hard to partner surgical schedules together when people are busy. You know, I'm eating into some of the efficiency of the PAO. You know, we started to see challenges technically of swelling related to arthroscopy. Some patients developing heterotopic bone formation because of different approaches and philosophies of NSAID use afterwards. You know, we're doing a PAO. We obviously don't want to inhibit bone healing. And so we would often not use NSAIDs after that, like we would in a normal arthroscopy. And so we kind of are trading back and forth those advantages and disadvantages. And then, you know, we got a little bit braver and braver. And as the outpatient ambulatory, you know, surgery niche, it became much clearer that performing these dysplastic arthroscopies outpatient with a cautious approach to capsular and labral preservation, cautious postoperative rehab, you know, without aggressive range of motion and risk of iatrogenic instability, we really were working to the advantages of both sides of the procedure. We were not delaying the PAO. We were efficient with our approach. We weren't having some of the issues and complications related to heterotopic bone formation, PAO surgeon having to work through the swollen tissue planes of a scope that had been freshly scoped with all the arthroscopy fluid. And even subjectively, you know, we even felt that there may be an advantage to patients in terms of their postoperative pain. So we kind of evolved from going early on, you know, pretty much 100% combined arthroscopy and PAO for at least probably the first couple hundred cases to, you know, now we might be 90% staged arthroscopy and PAO with maybe about 10% combined. And so that's why when we did this study, we looked at it in terms of the breakdown of about, you know, early stage and then late stage of practice and how we analyze this data. But with the, you know, with the size of the population we had treated, I think it became important to us to start understanding whether there was an advantage to one group or another, and whether some of our fears and worries were actually justified and there was data to support it. You know, so that was kind of the genesis of the study. It was really evaluating ourselves, as well as acting as sort of a cross-section, kind of a snapshot in time of where we were at in terms of the evolution of this comprehensive approach to structural hip disease.
Well, excellent. So now we know that there are some surgeons out there who will perform only a PAO for hip dysplasia, even though they have preoperative imaging that may show intra-articular pathology, such as a labral tear or cartilage delamination. Now, based on what you were describing with your practice and your experience working with PAO surgeons, it sounds like you really prefer to add the hip arthroscopy to the PAO, you know, now in a more staged fashion, previously in a simultaneous fashion. But can you talk us through the reasoning for adding a hip arthroscopy to the PAO?
Yeah, and this might be an example of a place where clinical experience and wisdom may actually trump some of the data. And there is actually data out of HSS showing that, arthroscopy paired with PAO versus PAO in isolation really have a very similar outcome. And there does not appear to be a distinct advantage over a combined approach versus index PAO. Now, I would say I appreciate and respect that data, but at the same time, in centers where referrals are coming in from elsewhere, we early on saw a fair amount of PAOs that had been done in isolation without arthroscopy, and patients who actually had persistent pain after the PAO. And you know, that knowledge, some of that wisdom generated more questions for us. And we went off and we wrote a systematic review on the utility of arthroscopy in the setting of structural hip disease. And we kind of broke it down into the various ways arthroscopy could be used, whether it could be used in isolation in some cases of borderline dysplasia, if it could be used after a PAO, if it can be used and should be used in a combined setting, what are the outcomes of PAO after arthroscopy has been done and failed. So these are some of the questions we started to ask. But because we had seen a decent amount of PAOs with continued pain due to unaddressed intraarticular pathology, we really felt that if we're going to be comprehensive about it and we're going to be thorough and we're going to feel confident looking at ourselves in the mirror that we had addressed everything possible, that we should at the very least, make sure that the findings on MRI were addressed, or, in some cases, from a staging standpoint and a cartilage mapping standpoint, we've probably had a handful of cases where imaging really did not reflect a higher grade or more advanced pattern of arthritis. But when we got in to address the interarticular pathology, found, a very substantial amount of degenerative disease to the point where we actually aborted or canceled the PAO. We carefully rehabilitated the patients, and then if they continue to decline afterwards, transition to total hip replacement. As you know, a PAO is a pretty substantial amount of recovery rehabilitation to go through, with challenges and potential for complications. And if at the end of it the person still has has quite a bit of osteoarthritis, the longevity or sustainability of that procedure may not work out very, very long into the future. So that was kind of our own personal rationale for this. And I would say in the majority of the cases, there is always something else to do in there. And we felt confident with our outcomes, and we've been very satisfied with that approach.
Yeah, Brian, I agree with you completely with that approach. And in my own practice, I would say if there's any intraarticular pathology on preoperative imaging, I also will perform a hip arthroscopy at the same time as the PAO. And I think you highlighted all of the same thought processes that I have in this scenario, but there are limitations to MRI. The sensitivity specificity can sometimes miss pathology. I do think that patients get better with a PAO alone, but I think they get even better if you address some of the loose cartilage flaps, large labral tears, and cartilage lesions that you can get to through arthroscopy. I also find in my hands the CAM decompression is a lot easier to do arthroscopically, as is the capsular repair. And then I even start to dissect some of my PAO dissection with the arthroscopic tools, which is a lot faster and more efficient for me as well.
Yeah, and I think I agree with that. I think that's a really nice way to approach it technically. And I don't know about you, but I sort of feel like I have learned so much about the role of capsule and the soft tissue envelope in terms of hip stability. I remember early on, it was always perplexing to me that after performing an arthroscopy in a highly dysplastic patient, you know, I would always expect when we would reduce traction that the hip would be subluxed or dislocated, because that's, you know, the early on, those were the papers that I had read that if you scope a highly dysplastic hip, it's going to lead to iatrogenic instability, even if you're cautious with labral and capsular preservation. And, you know, shockingly, they all reduced congruently. It just reminded me that the role of the periarticular soft tissue envelope and that dynamic force coupling and stability is so important. And, you know, I think it's really been interesting to look at the morphology of the bone as well. And I don't know, you know, if you feel the same, but, you know, whether it's disuse osteopenia or it's a weird kind of morphotype that can happen in these more dysplastic conditions, you know, they may not fall into the, you know, the realm of true CAM lesions. The bone is extremely soft. It can be very porous. You know, there seems to be a metabolic change of the actual articular cartilage. And it just, you know, for me has always been enlightening about this marriage between structural and biologic functional use and how this all fits together into a, you know, a really clinically challenging situation.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you that oftentimes it's not a true CAM that we see, but more of a squared off femoral head as a result of, you know, not having that counterplay between the acetabulum and the femoral head to form congruently. Interestingly, I mean, I think, I don't know if you have the same experience, but I, you know, doing a lot of straightforward FAI hip arthroscopies, as well as hip arthroscopies with basically every PAO that I do, I often find the PAO hip scopes are a lot more challenging than I would expect. So traction is often easier to get, but then the anatomy is a little bit of a challenge. There's, you know, hypertrophied labrum, you know, as we were just discussing, some of the bony morphology is different. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, technically these can be either very easy scopes in some cases, because as you said, they're lax, they're flexible. But in a lot of cases, when you're dealing with highly dysplastic patients, you have to change your portal position. I find I have to come in a bit more proximal because of the obliquity of the acetabulum. The landmarks are off. You kind of feel like you're in a hall of mirrors, like your orientation's a little bit off. And, you know, a lot of times you have this major hypertrophy of the labrum, and sometimes there's metaplastic blending of the articular cartilage to the labrum and even to the capsule sometimes. So I feel like I'm really trying to create a transitional zone if it doesn't seem to exist, or a distinction. You know, normally you rely on the subcapsular recess as a landmark to define your labral anatomy. In these cases, you know, patients think of the word tear that they hear a lot from radiologists. And often when we are scoping hips, we don't see true labral separation from bone and an actual hole. But these dysplastic patients, this is one scenario where there actually may be a true gap, and to find the true structural invagination point of the labrum can, in my experience, sometimes be challenging. You know, where do we put this labrum back onto? How is it gonna change once we reorient the acetabulum? Should we account for that in the femoroplasty to make sure we're not over resecting bone? You know, these are things that aren't, you know, the typical the typical points of orientation or visual landmarks that we would use in a routine scope that can become more complicated intellectually when we do the scope PAOs.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'd like to hear more based on your experiencing having performed both simultaneous and staged hip arthroscopy with PAOs, some of the pros and cons you've noticed with each scenario. You mentioned a few earlier on. You know, you found in your paper that the results are the same postoperatively as far as patient-reported outcomes and patient outcomes, whether you stage that arthroscopy or you perform it at the same time. But can you tell us a little bit more about the subtle differences in the, you know, immediate postoperative patient recovery that you've noticed? And I should put in a note here that I have also performed both simultaneous and some staged tip arthroscopy, but my absolute preference is to do it simultaneously. So I'll give you some counterpoints as you go through your pros and cons.
Sure. And again, some of this was our own evolution. And I think this really gets down to the individualization of practices, resources, hospital systems, commitment toward, toward arthroscopy and hip surgery. So if you have a an inpatient facility where orthopedics maybe does not necessarily have as much of a prioritization in the OR, in terms of the arthroscopy equipment or the familiarity of the surgical staff, that can really create some major headaches if your scrub tech's never scrubbed an arthroscopy case before. And that can be frustrating for you. It can increase operative time and anesthesia time. And sometimes can even take your focus away or distract you from, the task at hand, which is doing a good job for your patient. So, that's one thing. I think it's surgeon comfort and familiarity. There are some centers, like Rich Santori in San Diego who do outpatient PAOs. And I think as our capabilities of perioperative pain management improve and 23-hour capabilities improve, things like blood loss and technique continue to evolve, I think these things become more possible, and more feasible. It's safely doing 23-hour or even potentially outpatient scope PAOs, and where you can have the advantage of an ambulatory facility with personnel that are very familiar with the tools and the instruments, but also complete the more invasive part of the procedure simultaneously. So the advantage of doing it combined, if you're a center where patients are traveling from, it is a major inconvenience to logistically coordinate things like pre and post-operative visits, rehabilitation, the medical pre-op work that you do, and just the general travel, patients without means that don't have the money to spend to stay in a hotel or stay after surgery. And sometimes even just personal patient preference, they want this all done in one anesthesia period. And while even in our study, we didn't necessarily find an increased risk of medical complications related to two periods of anesthesia, this is certainly, impacts patients in terms of the investment emotionally and financially into the procedure. So Chris Cook, my partner, really preferred strongly that we not put patients on NSAIDs after the combined scopes and PAOs. And that was a personal preference and something that I think in part was really because we were very flexible about our indications early on for PAOs. And I think, for us, the oldest patient we did was, I think, 55 or 56. But we did get bitten a couple of times by this in trying to be so flexible. One, we can sometimes run into cases where the joint's more arthritic than expected, or two, issues related to delayed union, non-union. We had some interesting complications, even a psoas tendon incarcerated within a superior ramus cut, having to go back and disengage that through some very scary areas of the pelvis. So the NSAID issue was one thing. We'd occasionally get heterotopic bone because we didn't put patients on NSAIDs to try to optimize their healing. And then the technical portion of the procedure, doing a PAO through the murkiness of arthroscopy water, and then our perception that patients after a combined procedure had more pain than they would after a PAO in isolation or an arthroscopy in isolation. So, that's where we started to generally split them off, and we knew it was more safe and we had more comfort with the postoperative management strategies that we really weren't creating any iatrogenic instability or unsafe condition. We were cautiously managed, very tightly with our physical therapy colleagues. And, then I could put the patients on NSAIDs after the scope part of the procedure, but there was no risk of being on a long-term NSAID or an NSAID after a PAO. Chris didn't have to work through, a lot of the arthroscopy water that was all gone. He was in nice fresh tissue planes, and the patients seemed to have less pain after the PAO when done in a staged fashion. So that was, kind of the way that we evolved into, our current strategy for dealing with it. But, I'd love to hear your experience and what, what kind of an environment you have in Wisconsin and how you've been able to optimize that.
Yeah, you make excellent points, Brian. And I think your situation is probably going to be what most of the listeners' situation is as well, where, a hip arthroscopist partners with a PAO surgeon. And I think I'm in the unique position where I do both portions of the procedure. And so I work in a hospital where we do very high volume hip arthroscopy outpatient, but we can also admit patients overnight. And so I definitely prefer to just do everything in one setting, and I'm able to use the same table actually. So I don't have to change between the hip arthroscopy and the PAO portion any of the draping or the positioning. Everything's just the same. And then we've started using an injection around our osteotomy cuts, kind of a post-op surgical field block. And that has offered quite a bit of significant improvement in patients' pain after surgery. And so, you know, we haven't really noticed much of the increase in pain that you mentioned since using this block. And the other thing, you know, I do know that the fluid extravasation is notable. I actually almost prefer it. I feel like the fluid from the hip arthroscopy does some hydrodissection of the tissue planes for me and can actually make it slightly easier to do the PAO portion when I get there. But all, but I think, you know, your study goes to show that either way, you know, you get the same good results after surgery, which is very encouraging to hear.
Yeah, and I think it's just that really a testament to the dedication of surgical teams, and I think when you're really committed to hip preservation, I think it is really not something that you do recreationally, and to do well and to have good patient outcomes and satisfaction and safe transit from start to finish. I think, you know, this is where putting in all that effort and all that infrastructure over the course of years pays dividends for us long term, and really knowing your little microclimate within the hospital or the surgical center. And for, you know, for the listeners, what I would encourage, especially for new graduates and fellowship or interested sports medicine physicians or arthroscopists looking to, you know, to get into this but not quite sure how to create that partnership, I would submit that the hip world is probably the kindest, friendliest, most collaborative, you know, place to live sometimes in the world of sports medicine. And I think that I've learned this through Isha, through our subspecialty societies, that, you know, we are really all hip nerds in a way, and we like it that way. And we enjoy collaborating with local people and partnering to, you know, to the benefit of our patients. And I would say if you're intimidated, to reach out to you know, somebody local, because not only are they a resource for education, you know, their clinical acumen, technical expertise, but, you know, they're all very egoless, you know, very, very non-ego minded and driven when it comes to this. So be, you know, be brave and reach out and create those partnerships, because it can enhance the benefit of your patients, and also produce some really, really nice friendships and ways to improve your own practice.
Well, Brian, I completely agree, and I couldn't have said it any better. So on that note, I want to thank you again for joining us, for sharing your expertise and wisdom, and for publishing this paper that helps us treat these patients.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. And anybody has an interest in coming to hang out in Rochester, New York, we're always open for visitors.
Dr. Giordano's article titled "Patient-Reported Outcomes Are Similar in the First 2 Years After Staged versus Combined Hip Arthroscopy and Periacetabular Osteotomy for Hip Dysplasia" can be found online at www.arthroscopyjournal.org. This concludes our episode of the Arthroscopy Journal podcast. Thank you for joining us. The views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily represent the views of the Arthroscopy Association or the Arthroscopy Journal.